KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Any attempt to divide us through fear or harm has no place in Boulder, in Colorado, or anywhere in our nation.
Federal authorities have filed a hate crime charge against a man they say attacked people in Boulder, Colorado, the latest on the investigation.
It's Monday, June 2nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, we speak with a former member of the Department of Government Efficiency.
After 55 days assigned to the Department of Veterans Affairs, his credentials were suddenly revoked.
I did not find the federal government to be rife with waste, fraud, and abuse.
Also to the remote town of Whale Pass, Alaska, where the only school offers certified Taekwondo as a sport.
That may end up helping the school stay open.
Just to see the pride and the smile on their faces. Hey, we're on the map. We're on the map. I said, okay, now you got to go show them that you deserve to stay on the map.
That's coming up after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The man accused of throwing Molotov cocktails at a pro-Israel gathering in Boulder, Colorado, has been charged with multiple felonies, including attempted murder and using an incendiary device. Emma Van De 9D of member station KUNC reports he also faces a federal hate crime charge.
Investigators said 45-year-old Mohammed Sabri Saliman told them he had been planning the attack for a year, targeting, quote, the Zionist group. He said he wanted them all to die, and he would attack again if he could. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Dougherty says the attack was, quote, senseless and unjustified.
To all the victims, their loved ones, and to this community, I promise you that each one of us up here today will work tirelessly to ensure that justice is done and the defendant is held fully accountable.
Officials now say there were 12 victims. Boulder police are increasing security presence at events in the coming days. For NPR News, I'm Emma Van De 9D in Denver.
Thousands of low-income students nationwide are facing uncertainty over their careers and their housing. That's after the U.S. Department of Labor announced plans to suspend the Jobs Corps program. Catherine Davis-Young of member station KJZZ has more.
Job Corps provides free training in construction, medical assisting, security, and other skilled trades to low-income students ages 16 to 24. Many students were formerly homeless or in foster care, and many live on Job Corps campuses for free. Students on the Phoenix campus, like 18-year-old Yesenia Tapia, were given just a few days' notice that they'd have to move out.
I've been here for almost a year. I worked so hard. I don't even really have anywhere to go. And they just don't care. They really don't care.
The Trump administration says it's pausing Job Corps over serious financial deficits and reports of violence and other safety issues on campuses. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Davis-Young in Phoenix.
In Alaska, the Trump administration wants to lift Biden-era protections from oil and gas drilling on millions of acres of public lands. NPR's Jeff Brady reports the mostly undisturbed areas considered important habitat for wildlife.
At issue is about 13 million acres of land in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. While it's labeled a petroleum reserve, it's mostly undeveloped wild land. The debate over whether to allow oil companies to drill there has simmered for years. The American Petroleum Institute applauded the proposal to lift the year-old protections, saying the oil industry is important to Alaska's economy. Environmental groups opposed the move, saying wild places deserve protection from drilling rigs. Pollution from burning oil and gas are significant contributors to climate change. The Bureau of Land Management will collect comments for 60 days before issuing a final rule. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Stocks drifted modestly higher today, coming off a strong May. The Dow is up 35 points. The Nasdaq rose 128 points. This is NPR. Iranian, Egyptian, and U.N. nuclear leaders have met to discuss Iran's nuclear program after a key watchdog group said Iran appears to be increasing its stockpiles of uranium enriched to near weapons-grade levels. Confidential report was released during the U.S.-Iran talks by the U.N. Nuclear Watchdog Agency. Iran's president met today with Egypt's president and the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Today, a beloved eaglet left its nest high up in a pine tree in the mountains east of Los Angeles. Tens of thousands of people tuned in to the 24/7 live stream to marvel at the eagle's first flight. Madison Allman of member station KVCR has the story.
Sonny and Gizmo, who hatched in March, have become internet celebrities like their parents Jackie and Shadow. The pair of eaglets, believed to be females, were perched on a branch when Sonny flapped away. Sandy Steers, who operates the live stream, says it's a bittersweet moment.
She flew from the nest, and that gives her a much higher chance of success in life. But at the same time, it means we won't see her as much.
Steers says the duo has been practicing for weeks by jumping and flapping their wings. She says eagles can fledge between 10 and 14 weeks, and says Gizmo, who's several days younger, could fly soon too. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament.
Looks like that looming collision between our Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxies may not be quite as likely as some astronomers had thought. Latest study puts the chance of a galactic collision at 50-50 within the next 10 billion years. Essentially a coin flip, but better odds and further out than had previously been put forth. Findings were published in the journal Nature Astronomy. I'm Jack Speer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Federal authorities today filed a hate crime charge against the man they say attacked people in Boulder, Colorado yesterday, injuring 12 by throwing Molotov cocktails at them. These people were marching in support of Israeli hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. Mohammed Sabri Soleiman had his first appearance in court today. Colorado Public Radio's Haley May is following this story. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
What's he been charged with?
Right now, he's facing at least one federal hate crime charge based on the planned nature of the attack. And more could be coming because authorities say the materials he used to make the Molotov cocktails weren't manufactured in Colorado. And that could make this an interstate crime. Police say Soleiman told them he used the devices because he had previously tried to buy a gun but was not legally able to do so. They say he brought a total of 18 Molotov cocktails with him, but only threw two. Now, in addition to the federal charge, the Boulder DAs filed 42 counts against Soleiman. Those charges range from attempted murder to the possession of an incendiary device, and he's being held on a $10 million cash-only bond.
The victims were local members of a nationwide group called Run for Their Lives. They march every week as a way to call attention to Israeli hostages being held in Gaza. And authorities say that Soleiman shouted "Free Palestine" as he attacked them. What did he tell police about his intentions?
In an arrest affidavit, an FBI agent said Soleiman said, quote, he wanted to kill all Zionist people and wished they were all dead. He also told Boulder police that he would do this again and had planned to die in the attack. He covered himself in gasoline before police arrived. The FBI also says he researched Run for Their Lives and disguised himself as a gardener to attack the group, even buying flowers on his way to Boulder. He says he's been planning it all for a year and was waiting until after his daughter graduated high school to carry it out, but that no one knew of his plans, including his family.
Earlier, we were hearing from officials that 8 people were injured in the attack in Boulder. That number has now gone up to 12. Tell us what's happened.
Yes, that's right. Those most severely injured in the attack were 4 men and 4 women, all ranging in age from 52 to 88. All of them were hospitalized for burns, and at least 2 were airlifted to a specialized burn unit in Metro Denver. Today, we learned that 4 other people also sustained very minor injuries in the attack. At last check, one of the original victims was still listed in critical condition, but some have been released from the hospital, and we do know that one victim is a Holocaust survivor.
And what else do you know about Mohammed Sabri Soleiman?
Well, he's 45 years old, and the Department of Homeland Security says he entered the country in August of 2022 on a tourist visa and then filed for asylum the following month. His visa then expired in February of 2023. The arrest affidavit said that he's married and has 5 children. He told police he lived in Kuwait for 17 years and moved to Colorado Springs 3 years ago. That city's about 90 miles south of Boulder. Authorities say he left a journal at his home, which they raided yesterday, and police say his wife also brought them an iPhone where he'd shared messages for his family. It's likely that that phone will also be used in the investigation.
And what comes next in this case?
He'll be back in a Boulder courtroom on Thursday afternoon for the filing of local charges, and then he'll go through a similar process in federal court. As for the investigation, it's likely the FBI will continue to interview those that are close to him. We also know that he had additional materials meant to cause harm stored in the car that he drove to the event, and that the FBI is in possession of that vehicle.
That is Colorado Public Radio's Haley May. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
South Koreans go to the polls on Tuesday to elect a new president. This is after months of political upheaval. And as NPR's Se-Yoon Gong reports, the incoming president will find a deeply polarized country.
South Korea has been sharply divided ever since President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law in December. After widespread protests, the president was arrested on charges of insurrection. And eventually, he was removed from office. Yoon's opponents saw that as a victory for democracy. But to his supporters, it was an unimaginable defeat. This kind of polarization is not new to South Korea. In 2016, when President Park Geun-hye was impeached, protesters for and against her rallied for months. But back then, the country was mostly united, with around 80% of the public supporting the impeachment. This time, however, only around 60% did, and the demonstrations were more radical this time. In January, when a court issued the arrest warrant for President Yoon, more than 100 of his supporters smashed the court's windows and stormed inside. Some of Yoon's supporters also threatened law enforcement and clashed with Yoon's opponents. But they are not fighting over ideological differences.
It's not a matter of positions on an issue or a policy.
Yoo Sung-jin is a political scientist at Ewha Women's University in Seoul.
People just hate the other side. It's emotional polarization. So it's become a clash between us versus them, the good versus the bad.
Yoo says the emotional polarization encourages politicians to take extreme positions and use divisive rhetoric. On the campaign trail, the leading candidates from the two opposing parties are representing South Korea's deepening division themselves. Democratic Party's candidate Lee Jae-myung sees the election this way.
It will be a decision between a return of insurrectionists and a rebirth into a new democratic republic.
And here's the Conservative Party candidate Kim Moon-soo speaking of his rival.
They're trying to turn this great democratic country into something worse than Hitler, Kim Jong-un, Stalin, and Xi Jinping's country.
Kim has opposed the former president's impeachment and refused calls to cut ties with him. Instead, he has echoed the impeached president's accusations of the opposition as pro-communist. This divisive rhetoric is reflected in South Koreans' opinions about democracy. In a recent survey by the Seoul-based think tank East Asia Institute, over 30% of people expressed doubts about election fairness. And 30% of people supporting the ruling party said a dictatorship can be better than democracy.
We're certainly seeing people's trust in the rules of the game operating the system shaking.
Political scientist Yoo Sung-jin again.
If this situation continues, it can become much more dangerous.
Whoever is elected on Wednesday, the new president will face the difficult task of unifying the nation in the years to come. Se-Eun Gong, NPR News, Seoul.
The town of Whale Pass, Alaska is remote and tiny. It has fewer than 100 year-round residents and no grocery store. But in the past few years, it's gotten a new distinction. It offers certified Taekwondo as a school sport. That's all due to the passion of one 12-year-old boy. And as Michael Finelli reports, it may wind up saving the school from closing.
Ready, go.
One, sir. Two, sir. Three, sir.
On a big screen TV, senior master Demetrius Hill zooms in from Texas. He's leading a class of students aged 9 to 15. The internet connection starts to break up. But 12-year-old black belt Jesse Dempsey understands him just fine.
Sir, front row, back with the right foot,
Left low walk.
You froze again.
That's Jesse's mom, Michelle Dempsey.
We apologize for the technical difficulties, but this is a day in the life of Whale Pass Taekwondo. Exactly.
This year, only 7 students attended this K-12 school in Whale Pass, and all but 1 are in the Taekwondo program. Master Hill says last year, Alaska wasn't pictured on the regional Taekwondo competition map because there were no schools that participated. This year, it is.
And just to see the pride and the smile on their faces, hey, we're on the map, we're on the map. I said, okay, now you got to go show them that you deserve to stay on the map.
The Whale Pass kids have taken that to heart. 4 of them got first place in various events at a tournament in Idaho last October. And Jesse's mom, Michelle, says the Taekwondo world has taken notice.
It's really cool to see these kids from these little tiny communities that nobody has heard of go down to the lower 48 and, forgive me for saying it, kick butt and take names.
It all started when the Dempseys moved to town a couple years ago. Jesse had been training with Hill in Texas, and he didn't want to give that up.
That's who he looks up to. So I wanted to keep that dynamic going for him.
They decided to keep doing lessons on Zoom, and Jesse's peers quickly noticed the novel activity.
He was practicing on the playground at recess, and some of the other kids saw him. They were like, well, we want to do that too.
Hill invited the other kids to join in on the lessons, and they soon formed the only certified Sangam Taekwondo studio in Alaska.
Do you like living in Whale Pass?
I do. The only problem with living up here is probably the cost and the isolation.
As you can hear, Jesse's pretty mature for a 12-year-old.
It's very beautiful. There's really nice people and nice fresh air. You can see the night sky very well compared to down south.
If you ask his mom, that maturity is a product of Taekwondo. Whale Pass is hoping Taekwondo might be able to help them as well.
Whale Pass is a community that students are kind of in a shortage now.
Whale Pass School Superintendent Rod Morrison says if they can't get at least 10 students enrolled in the school by fall, they'll lose funding from the state. So they're creating a magnet school to draw curious students from elsewhere in the country.
We're hoping to attract some students from the lower 48 that want to come out and get Alaska cultural and Alaska studies and also the Taekwondo as well.
If they don't succeed, the school would have to close. But in the meantime, 4 students are getting ready to compete in the regional Taekwondo championships in Oregon, which start on Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Michael Finelli in Whale Pass.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. On March 17th, a man named Sahil Lavengia joined the Department of Government Efficiency as a software engineer assigned to the Department of Veterans Affairs. On May 9th, 55 days later, his credentials were suddenly revoked. On his website, he's now written about his brief experience working for DOGE, the cost-cutting unit formerly affiliated with Elon Musk and still associated with the Trump administration's ongoing efforts to cut programs and people from the federal government. And Sahil Lavengia is here to talk to us about it. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to start with this question. How is it that you ended up working with DOGE?
Yeah, so a friend of mine, he had a friend that was a software engineer for DOGE, and I applied for the U.S. Digital Service back in 2015 or so, and I've always wanted to ship code for the federal government. DOGE was the current way to do that, so I asked him for an intro. I spoke to him on a Signal. I spoke to a few other DOGE folks on Signal, and a few months later, they offered me a role at VA.
You mentioned that you had initially applied to work at the U.S. Digital Service, which is the department that DOGE sort of took over that was then rebranded. And I know that you were out there campaigning for Bernie Sanders back in 2016. And DOGE, of course, is this sort of signature day one initiative, the chief initiative of the Trump administration. Some people might be surprised that you would want to go and work there.
Yeah. I mean, I think the consistency is, I really believe that software can play a really important role in making being an American citizen like a better experience. You know, people are frustrated with the tools and technology that they have to use when they interface with the U.S. federal government. And I've always been interested as a software engineer ever since I was like a sophomore in high school. It's hard for me to think of a better way to have a larger impact as someone who writes code every day and enjoys, you know, designing and building products, web applications, iPhone applications, than working for the U.S. federal government. And Bernie, Hillary, Obama, Trump, it doesn't really matter to me if the work is making it easier to pay taxes or, you know, making it easier for veterans to collect benefits. I like when my software gets used by a lot of people and people send me nice emails. In this case, people weren't sending me the nicest emails, unfortunately, but they also didn't really know what I was doing. They saw DOGE, weren't a fan of certain things that they were associated with. But I think at the end of the day, like the role of the U.S. Digital Service is to improve the UX of being an American, which is pretty exciting. And anyone who lets me do that, I will try to work for, even if my friends and family aren't huge fans.
I want to ask you about something that you wrote on your website. You wrote that in reality, DOGE had no direct authority. The real decisions came from the agency heads appointed by President Trump, who were wise to let DOGE act as the fall guy for unpopular decisions. Can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think most of what I expected of it was from reading what was in the news and what was on Twitter, X, and it felt like DOGE had a lot of power, that DOGE was making a lot of controversial decisions, that DOGE was moving really, really fast. When I joined DOGE, I realized that while we were looped into a lot of things, effectively the agencies are the ones in charge. The agencies are the ones making the decisions to cut staff, to cut contracts, and DOGE and Elon was able to absorb a lot of the negative headlines that otherwise would have fallen on Marco Rubio or the agency heads or Trump or other folks in the administration.
As you've documented, by day three, you were compiling HR information for upcoming layoffs. The VA secretary has said his agency is targeting a 15% reduction in force, which multiple reports peg at somewhere between 70 and 80,000 people. So I want to ask you, if those people see you as someone who helped the Trump administration effectively push them out of a job, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, at the end of the day, I did help build org charts such that VA executives could understand like what their organization looks like. I don't believe that the VA will cut 15% of their staff. It's not actually possible, given that the vast majority of the VA is actually the 170 hospitals that serve veterans. And the VA has also said that they will not cut any jobs related to nursing, clinicians, physicians, anyone providing direct veteran care. when I've looked at the HR data that I had access to, it's just fundamentally not possible to cut 15% of the staff.
One of the big things that we've heard Elon Musk say and the president say as they've described the work of DOGE is that its goal is to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse, which they allege the federal bureaucracy is rife with. As you did more and more of this work in the time that you were involved with DOGE, did you find the federal bureaucracy to be rife with waste and fraud and abuse?
Frankly, no, I did not find the federal government to be rife with waste, fraud, and abuse. I was expecting some more easy wins. I was hoping for opportunity to cut waste, fraud, and abuse. And I do believe that there is a lot of waste. There's minimal amounts of fraud, and abuse to me feels relatively non-existent. And the reason is I think we have a bias as people coming from the tech industry where we worked at companies, you know, such as Google, Facebook, these companies that have plenty of money, are funded by investors, and have lots of people kind of sitting around doing nothing. The government has been under sort of a magnifying glass for decades. And so I think generally, I personally was pretty surprised actually at how efficient the government was. This isn't to say that it can't be made more efficient. Elimination of paper, elimination of faxing, but these aren't necessarily fraud, waste, and abuse. These are just rooms to modernize and improve the U.S. federal government into the 21st century.
When you did identify inefficiencies at the VA, I wonder, did you often identify the public interest reasons for why things might have been the way that they were?
Definitely. The sort of first thing that comes up anytime you question, you know, why does a veteran's disability claim take 133 days on average to process? The answer is not because people are just sitting around doing nothing all day long. It's because there are a lot of rules and regulations that Congress has put in place over decades that just make it very, very complicated.
You were a part of DOGE for 55 days. Can you walk us through what happened before you were let go?
Yes. So I probably stupidly was asked by a, not even a journalist, but a writer who just has a blog about my business going open source. And I spoke to him. You know, he had a bunch of questions about me working for DOGE. And I felt that Elon was pretty clear about how he wanted DOGE to be maximally transparent. That's something he said a lot in private and publicly. And so I felt, okay, cool. I'll take him at his word. I will be transparent and, you know, sort of an ask forgiveness, not permission sort of thing. I said mostly that the government was not as inefficient as I was expecting. And then my access got revoked pretty shortly after. I didn't get notified. I was basically ghosted. And I just got an email notification that my access was no longer valid.
I would just wonder if you've considered the fact that the Trump administration, it appears, let you go for speaking openly about your job, where we should note Elon Musk pledged maximum transparency, whereas you point out you wrote open source code for anyone to access. Those things seem to be in conflict.
I think that perhaps I was let go for another reason, right? That
What's that? What do you think?
I don't know. I can't think of any other reason. I'm just thinking that, like, unfortunately, they did not tell me directly that the reason I was let go was because of my transparency. So I don't know if irony is the right word, but I do think that it's maybe, as Elon says, the most entertaining outcome is the most likely. And, you know, letting someone go for being transparent in the most maximally transparent organization is a little bit entertaining.
We've been speaking with developer and angel investor Sahil Lavengia, who founded the online marketplace Gumroad. He joined the U.S. DOGE service for a brief time earlier this year. Sahil, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
A Yale psychiatry researcher says that the very human desire to seek revenge could be more than just an impulse. It may be an addiction.
Your brain on revenge looks like your brain on drugs, and that's exactly what the brain scans show.
He says humans have been hardwired to seek revenge, but he also thinks there's a way to change your brain. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ukraine hit Russia with a series of drone strikes destroying valuable Russian warplanes.
It's clear that the Russians are always sort of playing catch up and that the Ukrainians are the one innovating first and trying these sort of daring, creative attacks.
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Boulder, Colorado, criminal charges have been filed against the suspect in a Molotov cocktail attack yesterday that injured a dozen people, two of them still hospitalized. The FBI says 45-year-old Mohammed Sabri Soleiman told police he planned the attack for a year and specifically targeted what he described as the Zionist group, a reference to a movement to establish a Jewish state in Israel. J. Bishop Gruhl is the acting U.S. attorney for the District of Colorado.
When he was interviewed about the attack, he said he wanted them all to die. He had no regrets, and he would go back and do it again. He said that he had previously tried to purchase a firearm, but resorted to the Molotov cocktails when he could not purchase a gun because he was not a legal citizen.
Soleiman was charged with multiple state counts of attempted murder and a federal hate crime. The former head of New Hampshire's largest addiction treatment network is out of jail tonight on $1 million bond. Eric Spofford charged with orchestrating attacks on journalists. Allie Jarmanning has more.
Prosecutors say the 40-year-old Spofford orchestrated the vandalism at the homes of New Hampshire public radio journalists in 2022. He's accused of paying a close friend $20,000 to organize the attacks. Bricks were thrown through windows and threats were tagged with spray paint, including the phrase, "just the beginning." The vandalism came after New Hampshire Public Radio published an investigation alleging Spofford sexually harassed and abused women. Four men have already been convicted on charges related to the vandalism and are each serving prison time ranging from 21 to 46 months. Spofford funded and ran Granite Recovery Centers until 2021, when he says he sold the company for $115 million. For NPR News, I'm Allie Jarmanning in Boston.
This is NPR. Vehicles from Ford, Volkswagen, Volvo, and Chrysler were all recalled last month because of problems with the rear-view camera, which has been required in all new cars since 2018. NPR's Camila Domonoski has more.
More than 1 million Ford vehicles built in the last 4 years have a software error that could cause the images to freeze or be delayed. Meanwhile, many Volvos over the same time frame were reporting missing images, some of Chrysler's Ram ProMasters too. And some newer Volkswagen SUVs were struggling with distorted rearview images. In some cases, a simple software update will fix it, while some owners will need to visit a dealership. As always, with safety recalls, the repairs are free. You can check if your car is covered by any recall on the government's Safer Car app. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
After nearly four decades inside the NBA on TNT has come to an end, but its well-known personalities won't be leaving the show. That's because it's moving to ESPN and ABC next season, keeping its longtime host together for the Emmy Award-winning show with its NBA highlights, interviews, and hijinks. Ernie Johnson, Kenny Smith, Shaquille O'Neal, and Charles Barkley gave some emotional sign-offs over the weekend on TNT. Meanwhile, on Wall Street, stocks finished modestly higher to end the day, the Dow up about 0.8%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ukraine has carried out many highly creative drone attacks against Russia throughout the course of the war, and now they've taken it to a whole new level. Over the weekend, Ukrainian drones destroyed some of Russia's most valuable warplanes parked at military bases deep inside Russia. For more, we're joined by NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie, who has reported extensively on the war. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
Greg, I have to say these attacks were quite stunning. So tell us, how did Ukraine pull this off?
Yeah, Ukraine says civilian trucks were secretly driven deep into Russia and then parked just a few miles from these Russian military bases. The attacks were then launched remotely, allowing the hidden drones to fly out of the trucks and strike some of Russia's most valuable heavy bombers that were just parked out in the open at the bases. Now, Ukraine says it hit more than 40 Russian planes at bases from the Arctic Circle in the north to deep inside Siberia in the eastern part of Russia, more than 2,500 miles from Ukraine's border. Russia has acknowledged 5 bases were targeted, but has downplayed the damage and not offer details.
Wow. Have we ever seen anything like this before?
A short answer is no. I mean, Ukraine is officially calling this Operation Spider's Web. Some Ukrainians on social media are calling it Operation Trojan Trucks. So perhaps there's some ancient precedent here. Nothing like this in modern warfare. Here's Kelly Grieco at the Stimson Center think tank in Washington.
The Russians are always sort of playing catch up, and that the Ukrainians are the one innovating first and trying these sort of daring, creative attacks. And then the Russians are left scrambling to figure out how to defend against it, prevent another one.
Drone warfare is now central to both the Ukrainian and Russian military. So describe what this fight might look like on a typical day.
Yeah, Juana, we're now regularly seeing nights where most attacks are at night, where both sides launch upwards of 100 drones at each other. Russia fired 472 drones a couple nights ago, the most ever by either side. Ukraine shoots down or electronically jams most of these Russian drones, but, you know, even if 10% get through, they can cause a lot of damage. Russia's really looking in many ways to overwhelm Ukraine's air defenses with drones, and this clears the way sometimes for a more powerful Russian missile, which usually follows. Ukraine tends to use its drones in two ways. One, against Russian troops on the front lines, and second, longer-range attacks, which can be hundreds of miles inside Russia.
I mean, both countries have developed drone capabilities quite rapidly. Let's start off with Ukraine. How are they doing it?
Well, when Russia launched its full-scale invasion 3 years ago, Ukrainians began buying cheap Chinese civilian drones, like $1,000 or less, and attaching grenades to drop on Russian positions. This proved extremely effective, and Ukraine soon began making their own. Many hundreds of private companies are now making them. Ukraine made more than 2 million drones last year, plans to make more than 4 million this year.
And quickly, Greg, what about Russia?
Well, Russia is not as innovative. It was buying drones from Iran. Now it's bought that technology from Iran, making its own. The quality isn't great, but they do make a lot of them.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thanks.
Sure thing.
Under the UN Convention Against Torture, the U.S. is not allowed to deport migrants back to their home countries who are likely to be tortured by their own governments. But the Trump administration has been changing how it handles asylum seekers, first blocking people from requesting asylum at the southern border, and now changing how it processes people who say they are likely to be tortured if they're sent home. The California Newsroom's Mark Betancourt has been following the case of one woman whose treatment reflects some of these changes. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ari.
Before we get to this particular case, how is the Convention Against Torture supposed to work?
So to get this protection, people have to go to immigration court to make their case. But first, they have to have an interview with an asylum officer to make sure their fear of torture is credible, basically. And that screening interview seems to be working very differently since President Trump signed an executive order back in January suspending asylum access at the southern border.
Tell us about what's changed.
So the government has not been forthcoming about this, so we've been sort of piecing it together from different sources. But the order seems to have stripped protections for people going through these Convention Against Torture screenings. It used to be that you had time before the screening to find a lawyer, and they could be at that screening with you. Also, if the asylum officer said, basically, no, your fear is not credible, you could appeal that decision in court. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. We got a hold of the new federal guidelines for asylum officers through public court filings. And according to these new guidelines, all those protections are now gone. No lawyer, no appeal option. I spoke with quite a few immigration attorneys, and they confirmed that this is how things are working. And they say these screenings are now shorter. They used to last as long as a few hours. Now, some are only lasting a few minutes. And people are getting denied at this screening stage without any explanation.
And does that mean that people who fear torture in their home countries are actually being deported?
Yes. We've been following the case of this woman from Ethiopia who is currently in immigration detention outside San Diego. We're not naming her because she's scared of retribution for herself and her family back in Ethiopia. According to her attorney, she says that she was tortured by Ethiopian officials after she inadvertently saw the military execute a group of people. She says they threw her in prison for more than a week and beat her and threatened her and her family just for having been a witness. She did have a screening interview with an asylum officer, like we talked about earlier. But even though attorneys say someone like her really should qualify for protection under the Convention Against Torture, the officer denied her. And under the new rules, that's it. No appeal. Right now, it looks like she'll be deported back to Ethiopia. And this is just one of a number of stories I've heard from attorneys across the country.
Do you have any way of knowing how many people are affected by these changes?
Basically, no. All we have are these anecdotal examples like this woman's because the government stopped publishing data about these screenings when President Trump took office. We do know that last year more than 20,000 people passed these screenings. That was before they stopped publishing them. But there's no way to know if that number would be similar now because border crossings have gone down so much. I spoke with Natalie Cadwallader-Schulteis. She's an attorney at Human Rights First. She thinks the government has made this whole process opaque on purpose.
They don't want us looking under the hood. They don't want us to understand it because if we did, I think it would be very apparent just how illegal and much of a sham this whole thing is.
I should add that her organization said in a recent report that some migrants who say they're afraid to return to their countries aren't even getting these screenings. They're just being deported.
What does the Department of Homeland Security say about this?
I asked DHS about each change to the Convention Against Torture screening guidelines and the allegations in the Human Rights First report. They did not answer my questions. They just sent some links to what seemed to be outdated public websites that don't even reflect these changes. I also asked about this Ethiopian woman's case in particular, and they said they wouldn't answer questions about specific cases. Now, there are a couple of federal court cases challenging the president's executive order, so we'll see what happens there.
That is Mark Betancourt with the California Newsroom. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. And now for a story about a homecoming for a tiny dog named Valerie. She's a mini dachshund who ran away during a family camping trip on a remote Australian island. And she survived on her own for 529 days. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has the story.
Valerie, roughly 10 pounds with short little legs and a long black body, doesn't quite look like a dog who recently survived more than 17 months in the Australian wilderness. She's sitting on the couch, bundled in a blanket, on the laps of her owners, Georgia Gardner and Josh Fishlock, as they talk over Zoom.
She's the queen of the house. It is her house and we live in it.
But for well over a year, Valerie was missing from that house after getting spooked on a camping trip in a remote area of Kangaroo Island back in 2023.
We searched and searched.
Hiking through the hills for 5 days, nonstop.
And eventually, the couple had to return home to mainland Australia.
The decision to leave the island was probably the hardest decision I think I've ever made in my life, because we went over there as three and we were going back as two.
They tried to hold out hope that someone would find her, but weeks turned into months and still there was no word about Valerie. Until this February, more than a year after she first disappeared, when a farmer on the island snapped a photo of a tiny black dog running through a field. That photo made it to Lisa Karen.
Said, "Oh, that must be the little Valerie that went missing a year ago."
Lisa and her husband Jared run Kangala Wildlife Rescue, a local organization generally focused more on working with wildlife than pets. They'd originally been in contact with Valerie's parents when she went missing.
So it sort of started from there.
Lisa says that's when they got to work, trying to rescue Valerie during their off hours. It was no small feat. First, they put out about a dozen small, basic traps, but caught pretty much everything except Valerie. Possums, feral cats, wallabies.
Even some kangaroos put their little big heads in there.
So, along with a team of other volunteers, they began experimenting, often working long nights with little to no sleep, documenting along the way.
We're out in the middle of nowhere. It's 3:30 in the morning. It's freezing cold. It's like 5 degrees.
Eventually, they rigged up a big pen with a roof, several wildlife cameras, and a remote-controlled door.
We've set up the cage with all the comforts of home for little Valerie. We've got her toys and teddies and blankets.
Setting it in the spot where Valerie had last been seen. And finally, after nearly 2 months, everything lined up. Valerie entered the pen, relaxed a little bit, and they hit the remote to drop the door. No one quite knows exactly how Valerie survived. Lisa speculates she was drinking water from nearby farms, burrowing for shelter and scavenging for food. After her capture, Valerie went to the vet and got a clean bill of health. She'd even gained some weight.
She's got the physique of like a little bodybuilder.
Valerie has been back home for about 2 weeks. Her owners say she settled right back in, playing with her toys, cuddling in bed, going on walks. But Gardner says she's not exactly the same.
She's kind of come back a little bit more independent.
Gardner and Fishlock say they've been flooded with messages, with many people saying Valerie's story gave them hope.
You know, if a tiny little 4-kilo sausage dog can survive on Kangaroo Island in the Australian bush, then, you know, you two can survive whatever it is you're going through.
But clearly, Valerie is also content bundled in a blanket, sitting on a couch, too. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News.
And if you want to see photos of little Valerie, head on over to NPR.org.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump pardoned or granted clemency to more than two dozen people last week, among them a former Virginia sheriff and vocal Trump supporter facing 10 years in prison for bribery. His name is Scott Jenkins. Writing on Truth Social, Trump called Jenkins a victim who was, quote, persecuted by the radical left monsters and left for dead. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports on the mood from Culpeper County, where the sheriff served for a dozen years.
I'm here at the Frost Cafe on Main Street. It has these big black and white awnings outside. Egg sandwich starts at about 3:25. And at breakfast, there are all these people packing the burgundy stools that line the counter. So I'm asking people what they think of the president's pardon of the former sheriff.
It's a failure of our justice system. He was guilty as could be. He needed to go to jail, and he didn't. So what kind of a signal does that send?
Totally surprised. Stunned. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I believe everyone is against it.
You haven't found a single person who supports the pardon?
Negative. I have not found one yet.
That was Ken Green, a retired entrepreneur, and John Cook, who runs a tree service. Both voted for Trump, as did more than 60% of Culpeper. That last voice was Gordon Clore. He's a retired salesman who did not vote for Trump. Ken Green, who voted for him three times, says the pardon undermines the rule of law.
It's a slap in the face, just like pardoning all of the January 6th people. I mean, some of them needed to go to jail.
You still support him?
It's kind of a two-edged sword. I mean, you either support him or you support the other side, and I can't support the other side right now. So, I mean, it's the lesser of two. It's the evil you know.
A jury convicted Jenkins last year for effectively selling auxiliary deputy badges to businessmen for $75,000 in cash and campaign contributions. This was mostly local news. So the president's decision to pardon a little-known county sheriff left many here puzzled, including John Cook.
How could he know Sheriff Jenkins when he lives in D.C.? What connection was that?
One connection was this man.
This is the Stone Zone with Roger Stone.
Roger Stone is a longtime Trump confidant. Speaking on his podcast, Stone said he and others urged the president to pardon Jenkins, who appeared as a guest on last week's episode. Stone commiserated with the former sheriff, saying that he too had been unfairly targeted by the justice system.
I have been in your shoes, my friend, the Lord heard those prayers, which is why the president became well aware and acquainted with your case that you were framed for strictly political reasons.
Stone himself was convicted of witness tampering and lying to Congress in 2019. Trump commuted his sentence. Former Sheriff Jenkins claims the Biden Justice Department went after him for various reasons, including what he says were his plans to try to examine Hunter Biden's laptop and his vow a few years back to counter gun control legislation. Here's how Jenkins put it to Breitbart at the time.
I will swear in tens of thousands of citizens as deputy sheriffs, provided they have their own weapons and be on call and available to me for service, and they will be allowed to keep those AR-15s.
But the criminal case painted a very different picture of Jenkins. Federal prosecutors presented video that they said showed Jenkins taking bribes from businessmen for auxiliary deputy badges. In return, the businessmen were told the badges could allow them to carry a concealed weapon without a permit and get them out of traffic tickets. A jury convicted the former sheriff after just 2 hours of deliberations. A couple of blocks from Culpeper's Frost Cafe, Shelly Tutt is digging into breakfast, sausages wrapped in pancakes. She's at a restaurant called the Four Seas. Tutt did not vote for Trump. And she finds something unsettling about a legal system where the president pardons a convicted felon while his administration detains some immigrants on valid visas without charge.
There's no due process, but yet you can take criminals and pardon them with a blink of the eye. It's just not right. It's like gangsters running the country.
On Truth Social, Trump says Jenkins and his family were, quote, dragged through hell by a corrupt and weaponized Biden DOJ. After Jenkins was indicted in 2023, he ran for a fourth term as sheriff of Culpeper. He won just 20% of the vote. People here say Jenkins rarely shows his face in town anymore. Frank Langford, NPR News, Culpeper, Virginia.
June is Pride Month, a time to recognize LGBTQ people's history and impact. Of course, the word pride wasn't always shorthand for LGBTQ empowerment. NPR's Juliana Kim has this history lesson.
Pride was considered one of Christianity's seven deadly sins when it first appeared nearly a millennium ago. But within a few hundred years, the word took on a more positive spin, meaning a reasonable form of self-respect. Fast forward to the 1960s, the concept of gay pride started to emerge.
There was even a group in Los Angeles that was founded in 1966, so 3 years before Stonewall, that used PRIDE as its acronym. It stood for Personal Rights in Defense and Education.
That's Mark Stein, a history professor at San Francisco State University, who's written 6 books on LGBTQ history. He says gay activists were inspired by the terms Black Pride and Black Power used during the civil rights movement. Gay pride didn't really take off until after the Stonewall riots in 1969, when police raided a bar in New York City known to welcome gay patrons, sparking days of protests and becoming pivotal in the fight for LGBTQ rights. A few months later,
it was then, November 69, at this meeting of East Coast gay activists, that the decision was made we should have a march in New York and in other places on the anniversary of Stonewall.
There was debate about what the slogan should be. Some wanted gay power, but organizer L. Craig Shoemaker pushed for pride. He told The Illusionist in 2015, a few years before his death, that not everyone can have power, but anyone can have pride in themselves. It took a few more years, but soon the LGBT community rallied around the word and its meaning.
It had special resonance for LGBTQ people because the notion before the 70s that gay people were sinful, were diseased, were criminal was so powerful that many people internalized that.
The LGBTQ community has made significant strides since its original marches, but in recent years they've experienced pushback from political and religious conservatives.
I think the strength of the backlash or the backsliding is a measure of how successful the movement had been for 50 years.
Stein adds that progress is rarely linear. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Center's one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of